international student world that we live in, exactly. So we've got lifestyle issues, we've got worldview issues, we've got the tendency to retreat, globalisation, all of that. It's interesting that, and I'm sure this maybe did come up around one or two tables, that one of the things that folks often maybe focus in on are lifestyle issues. You know, what happens if all my friends are going clubbing and I don't particularly want to go, and I'm getting drunk every night and I don't particularly want to do that. What I want to focus on here is how very much issues of worldview and issues of, you know, making those independent commitments to what we believe are at the heart of maybe all the other stuff, including lifestyle stuff. So you've got to start much deeper than maybe where the surface pressures are manifesting itself. You know, living with a lot of folks who don't believe what you believe, all of that. You will be grounded in how to respond in that context if you have stuff sorted out in terms of your own personal commitment to Christ and worldview and what you believe. Now, this is working again, is it? I think it is. There's a light on. That's always helpful. So, the university has been called, in much of the literature, the secular cathedral. But just as in the Middle Ages, the cathedral was the place of authority and where everything was unified and the worldview was decided, so too now that has been taken over by the university as the place of authority. There is an element of authority given to the latest academic research on any subject. The whole point of what I want to say is that it's not just a case of survival, and maybe this was behind your point, that the tendency will be, if I can get through my university years, or even get through that first transition into work life, and survive as a Christian all as well, I've made it. I don't believe that's good enough. You know, I don't want folks just to survive at university, I want them to thrive. in some ways, it's interesting because I work for IFAS Ireland, which is the Christian Union movement for the whole of Ireland. And we're already getting phone calls into our office from parents saying, we're having a family holiday in the summer, but my son or my daughter's going up to university next year. I know you have a pre-term for all the Christian Unions. I don't want them to miss that. What are the dates? And that's great. I mean, it'd be great to have them. It's wonderful to think that. But there's almost this sense of panic in the voice. If I can get them to the preterm, if I can get them into the Christian Union, then everything will be okay. And sometimes we get phone calls from parents saying, what's happened to my daughter? Why is the Christian Union not looking out for them? Forgetting that when you're 18 or 19, you make your own choices. And I think that there can be this tendency, particularly in the part of well-meaning parents, to say, if only you get involved with the Christian Union. And then what we find is that if the person is doing that simply because to please their parents, or simply because it is maybe an easy environment for them, if they don't have a crisis of faith at 18 and 19 when they go to university, they're going to have it at 23 and 24 when they leave university and go into the working life. So this is a time when you've got to own for yourself the faith that you've been professing. It's quite possible, for example, to look at things like this. To see a Christian fellowship at university as a sort of an oasis, as a sort of little bubble where you can survive for 4 or 5 years without any relation to what's going on in the rest of your life or the rest of the university. For many years, there's been a movement called the Faith and Work Movement about integrating faith with your work environment. And I want to apply some of what they have discovered and learned into the university context. Because a guy called David Miller has come up with these 4 quadrants that typify a lot of the research in faith and work. And so, for example, in the faith and work movement, there are some ministries that see the role of faith and work being like a lunchtime prayer meeting, or a lunchtime Bible study, a lunchtime fellowship where like-minded Christians can get together for support before they go back into the reality of their business or their company or their multinational or whatever. And I'm not dissing that, but it's got to be more than that. It's got to be more than just that bubble. You know, the purpose of meeting together would be to protect and affirm. To protect you from the difficult realities of work life or university life, to affirm you in your faith, and the context, whether it's the university or the work life, is seen as being hostile. Then there is the other movement, which is the evangelism movement, saying the sole purpose of a Christian group in the workplace or in the university is to evangelize, so that you will have maybe a lunchtime evangelistic meeting, or you will invite your work colleagues to something that's going on in your church. And again, in the university context, the CU is seen as something that is there to evangelize, which it is. And that's the reason for our existence as a society. But as an individual, if you think the only way that university life or work life relates to you as a Christian is when you're sharing your faith with your friends, that is very limited. It's got to be more than that. Here, of course, if the last one was the circling of the wagons to protect, this is the frontline troops going out, and the purpose of a Christian group at work or at university is to train you for evangelism, to go out and to proclaim. And the context here is seen totally as being lost and without hope. So hostile, lost, and without hope, whether it's university or the workplace. Then there is what's called the ethics quadrant. And that applies to where you're asked to do something that is against your principles. So the only purpose of a Christian group at work or at university is to stand up at times when Christians are under pressure to do things that are against their conscience, to behave in an immoral way or in an ethical way. And so the purpose would be to be dissenters, to be lobbyists, to stand up and represent the Christian position. The context is seen as immoral and corrupting. And again, there are elements of truth in this, but it's got to be more than that. And finally, there's what I call, and I just chose the word eclectic for a fourth E. It really means that the whole purpose of relating your faith to work or to your studies only applies to a selective group of disciplines, a selective group of workplace careers or vocations, a small eclectic group that maybe within the caring professions, if you're a medic or a social worker or something like that, there's a very clear way of how your faith inspires your work or your faith inspires your studies. But what if you're in advertising or PR or sales or journalism? What if you're studying the arts? It's not so easy. In fact, sometimes people would undermine the role that you could have in that context. So here the purpose of a Christian group or a Christian fellowship is to promote Christianity, but only within certain areas or certain vocations. The context is seen as ambivalent. It might be sympathetic, it might be hostile. Now, what about the university? I know that not everybody is in a Christian union. I appreciate that. I'm speaking from that context because I think, obviously, it's important that there is a Christian group for a variety of these reasons on campus. But if you're solely thinking that the role for you as a Christian is one of enrichment and fellowship, then you're going to feel alone. And therefore you want to hunt out fellowship. This meets the need of the Christian who feels alone. I need other Christians, I need to know where they are, I need support. But then, as I said, the CU can become a bubble and can have little or no impact on the context. The context is hostile, we circle the wagons, we don't do anything more than that. For the one who favours the evangelism role, that meets the need of the Christian who has a heart to share their faith, which is great. The CU is seen as a mission team on campus, which again, as I said, is actually true. It's our reason as a Christian union, as a society. The only reason we exist as a society, if it was just for fellowship, there are other groups who do that. If it was just for ethics, there are other lobby groups that can do that. So we are a CU as a mission team. But as a Christian, as an individual, your interaction with the university, your living out of the Christian life, must be more than that. Then the Christian who faces dilemmas, they will be drawn towards a CU that is more of a lobby group, stands up to say, it's okay not to do this, it's okay to stand against that, it's okay to absent yourself from that. But again, that's, if you like, a totally negative
view of what it means to be a Christian, and you're always standing against something. Or the Christian Union as a lobby group, we're facing this in the Republic of Ireland at the minute, because for years, many of the colleges there have not allowed, for example, a pro-life group to form because it's been against the student union policy. Now suddenly there's a big referendum and they're trying to have a debate and they can't find any pro-life groups to have the debate with because they've all been banned, so they turn to the Christian Union. And I'm saying, yes, listen, we have something to say to this. We want our individual members to be part of this debate. We want them to be active. But the CU is not a lobby group. We don't want to be seen that that's our purpose. It's got to be much, much more than that. And then for the Christian who likes to compartmentalise their life in that this is to do with my faith and then this is to do with my work, they might be drawn to the idea that, well, if I'm a doctor or if I'm in the caring professions, then that's okay. But as one student said to me, well, I'm studying mathematics, there's absolutely no relation between my faith and my study. Well, really? How about trying to find out? I read a couple of books that have been written by Christian mathematicians that show some of the underlying faith presuppositions that have influenced mathematics over the years. The CU can't just be a limited equipper for certain groups. So whether you're an individual or whether you're in a wider group, you've got to have an all-rounded, a much more integrated, a much more holistic view of what it means to be a Christian and applying that to your study. What's the problem? Is the university, is the student population hostile? Is it lost? Is it immoral? Is it ambivalent? Well, of course, the answer is yes and no. Yes and no. Some are, areas are, aspects are, but that's not the whole story. So what does it mean for you to engage the university, or in some people's case, the workplace, and also embrace student life or embrace working life as a Christian? What does it mean to have an integrated view of life as a student? You see, those four quadrants that I showed are wrong or only partly right. You are not called to be enriched in a bubble. Yes, you do need to be enriched, you do need to be fed, you do need to be nourished. The Christian Union can do part of that. The church, of course, does it much better. But you're not called to be enriched in a bubble. You're enriched as you live out your Christian life in all the areas that God has called you to live in. Neither are you called to evangelize in a vacuum. You are called to share your faith. But if you're only doing it, if you're only doing it as an activity that is totally separate from any relationships you have with those students or workmates at other times, and you're not part of university life or working life in any other way, then the evangelism will lack integrity and fruit. Ethical decisions are also much more complex, and that's what Peter will be talking about next door. They apply to much more than the usual big issues. So you can actually, for example, feel quite confident about your view on something like, same-sex marriage or abortion, something like that. But maybe you've never questioned the assumptions behind capitalism and some of the economic decisions that are being made. Maybe you've never questioned the assumptions behind literary theory if you're an English literature student. Maybe you've never questioned the assumption behind some of the social sciences. You're suddenly realising that there are bigger ethical issues here than I imagined. And so it's got to be more than being a lobby group on one or two current issues. And Christian faith has implications for all disciplines and all vocations. Some foundational principles. Basically, I'm saying to you this morning that in order to live this integrated life at these times of transitions, you need to get God right, you need to get yourself right, and you need to get God's world right. You need to get God right, you need to get yourself right, and you need to get God's world right. God hasn't abandoned his creation. He hasn't abandoned our country. He hasn't abandoned your university or workplace. And he hasn't abandoned you. He wants to be intimately involved in all decisions you have made. He is as interested in you when you are halfway through that assignment on the imagery in Dostoevsky as he is when you're sitting down reading the gospel with a non-Christian friend. He's as interested in you when you are putting together your art portfolio as he is when you're evangelizing or reading the scriptures. And he is the source of comfort, truth, wisdom for all areas of life. Now, do you notice why I use those words? He is the source of comfort, truth, wisdom for all areas of life. Simply because those are the needs manifested by the four quadrants. You know, they see you as a bubble. People are looking for support and comfort. He is the comforter. Evangelism, they're interested in proclaiming the truth of the gospel. He is the truth. They're realizing they need wisdom to make ethical decisions. When to speak, when not to speak. When to stand up, when not to. God supplies that wisdom. And he does it in all areas of life. Abraham Kuyper's famous quote, "There is not a square inch in the whole domain of our human existence over which Christ, who is sovereign over all, does not cry, mine." So, that's getting God right. Maybe we stop for any questions at this point about the quadrants. I've no idea about relating your faith to your university studies and how you see. Somebody says, what does it mean to be a Christian student? What does it mean to be a Christian, you know, doctor? What does it mean to be a Christian in retail? Do you tend to think, well, it just means finding other Christians or evangelizing or not doing anything unethical? Sort of getting that picture. Any questions?
What about emerging professions?
So,
in terms of computer science, yeah. So what do you mean? How does the Christians, how does that look in the years by Christianity, as you say, mathematics, English?
Okay.
Right,
okay, the question was, does Christianity have the same influence over some of the emerging, especially technological fields and professions? I would say that, yeah, I didn't want to overplay like the influence that Christianity has in some of the, I mean, it's much more obvious maybe in some of the earlier literature, even in some of the earlier hard sciences. And therefore, there can actually be a bigger challenge towards what are the ethical issues surrounding some of the emerging professions in terms, I suppose, of what they say about our humanity, maybe some of the fears of dehumanization and, isolation. What I would say is that I suppose one of the things that comes out of some of the emerging businesses and technologies and everything is the potential for isolation and loneliness. Because so many of the new jobs, you can work from home, you can decide your own hours. In fact, I saw an article recently whereby somebody was, I think it was a colleague of mine in the States, it was his wife was involved in this in the States, renting space for self-employed home workers in the technology industry so that they could actually have a workplace to go to. They were all working for different companies, but it was somewhere in this. And they could actually go simply for a degree of social interaction and simply to have that rhythm of life so that you're going sort of separate from home. Because what they were finding was with some of the emerging technologies and all of that, that it was having a bigger interruption in the work-life balance, it was having a bigger interruption in family life, it was leading to isolation and people having to deal with the pressures of that on their own. So I think there are lots of implications arising from some of these new ones that are challenges for the Christian. And in terms of Christian influence or not, I don't suppose that's as important as Christians in those emerging jobs being able to think critically about what are the underlying assumptions behind this. You know, that if we actually are able to do things, I mean, the difference between information and knowledge, the difference between an information-heavy society and a wisdom deficit society. Those are big questions that I think would be great for people who are in those jobs to get together and to tease out. One of the things that we're trying to do as IFES over the next few years is to get people together who have graduated into certain professions so that they can ask exactly these questions and say, who has done some work in this area and how can we encourage one another to be at the front of this field of research and yet be faithful to God? I think it's just a case of being able to ask the big questions
Because even in the areas where there was Christian influence, there was always economics. There have been competing philosophies there, maybe some more or less compatible with a Christian worldview. Same in political science. So it's not that Christian influence has always been there. It's been one voice in some of these. Anything else? What does it mean to get yourself right? Well, it's answering the big question, who are you? When I asked a friend about when I was preparing for this, and I said, what do you think the key thing is in talking about this issue to students and graduates? They said, make sure you focus in on the issue of identity. And I think he's right, because there will be lots of competing views telling you who you are that lie behind some of the political and sub-political groups and messages that are going around. For example, you are your gender. You can choose to be what you want. You are your sexuality. That is what defines you over and above everything. You are your social circle. You are the school you went to. You are your social class. You are your political culture. You are your academic achievements. You are your career. And those will be tempting identities to assume instead of the one that you are called to be. So, is it your gender, sexuality, friends, culture, grades, career? Well, some of those are given, some of them are chosen, some of them are earned, some of them are accepted unthinkingly, but they are all sub-identities or even non-identities. And all have to be placed under the Lordship of Christ. That is the radical truth of the gospel for today. When we talk about the Lordship of Christ, it doesn't just mean that you obey Christian rules and regulations. It means that everything else that is calling for your unwavering allegiance, whether it is a political culture or a political agenda or a materialistic pool, cannot have overall influence on you. It's interesting, for example, take the whole issue of sexuality, which of course is an ongoing massive issue. The big problem there is not the seventh commandment, you know, the extension of thou shalt not commit adultery, therefore sinning in a sexual realm breaks that commandment. It does, but only because the first commandment has been broken. You shall have no other gods before me. I think it's Tim Keller who says you don't break any of numbers 2 to 10 until you've first of all broken number 1. And because it's so primarily, it is an identity issue. If you're choosing a particular form of sexual identity and practice, whether it be heterosexual or homosexual or bisexual, if you're choosing that and saying that is who I am, then you're actually breaking the first commandment, which says no, primarily you are a child of God and called to live for him. As a Christian, that is your identity. You're a child of the Father, a completely forgiven sinner, who by his grace is dearly loved by him unconditionally, adopted into his family with all rights and inheritances, and called by him to live out this radical new identity wherever he has called you. A quotation from David Montgomery yesterday. But I think that sums up the biblical teaching of who you are as a Christian. You're a child of the Father, a completely forgiven sinner by his grace, dearly loved by him unconditionally, adopted into his family with all rights and inheritances, and called by him to live out this radical new identity wherever he has called you. And that includes the university. And that identity trumps all other identities. And so, that's who you are in terms of your identity. Who are you in terms of your current location? This came from something I did for our IFES World Assembly last year, what it means to be a Christian student. And again, it's a long quote, but just follow me through here. Being a Christian student begins with acknowledging that I'm using the mind given to me by God to study God's universe, and that there's no realm of human inquiry to which his word and wisdom are not to be applied. It'll involve engaging with the theories, practices, literature and research of my chosen discipline and other related disciplines with integrity and inquisitiveness. It'll mean being humble enough to learn from others, regardless of their faith commitment, accepting light from any quarter, and yet brave enough to challenge perceived presuppositions where necessary and demonstrate how a Christian worldview can contribute to and enrich the field of study. Basically, what it's saying is that you use your brain, you study well, you engage, you're humble, you take stuff that's written in by non-Christian authorities where it can reflect God's truth, God's common grace, his natural revelation, and yet you're prepared, and this comes back to your point about the emerging careers and technology, that you're able to look back and say, well, who started all this? What was their thinking? What were their presuppositions? And being able to challenge some of those where necessary and show how a Christian worldview can actually enrich technology, putting it in context, making life convenient and helpful for people, helping the poor, but never being our God and never being our master. So, be a Christian and be a student. Because God has called you to be one. If you're at college or if you're just about to go to college, it's not a sort of a four-year waiting room with a massive drinks cabinet until you get out the other end. That's how a lot of people treat it, isn't it? You know, that's how people treat their universe. How you can be different as a Christian is actually by having a different attitude to your studies. Because God has called you to be there and he's given you amazing opportunities that many in the world will never have. Scripture affirms the wisdom of interdisciplinary study. I don't have all the references here, but if you look particularly through the wisdom literature of Proverbs and Ecclesiastes, you will see the writer extolling the virtues of being able to study God's world. It's part of your mission to be a good student. That's how your lecturers and your teachers and some of your fellow students will see that as well. And above all, it will ground you for faith and work integration. What I'm saying there, and those of you who are at work might bear me out on this, if you haven't thought this through at university, if you haven't thought about what it means to be a Christian student, you're going to have a lot more difficulty in thinking, what does it mean to be a Christian, whatever comes next? I've sometimes used this example too in terms of our finances. If you haven't learned to give or to tithe or to be generous as a student when you don't have very much, you're going to be faced with a massive culture change and mind shift when you get your first paycheck. You know, for me, some of those decisions about independent living, about what I do with my money and what I do with my time, were made not when I got my first job, but when I started university. When those rhythms were taken away and I went away from my parents, I went overseas and I went away from my church, and suddenly I could write the script. Well, God was writing it, of course, but from my perspective, I was saying, I make choices now about how much of my time I use for myself and how much I use for volunteering and for others, all under God, how much of my money I use for myself and how much I give to others. And similarly, how I look upon the whole issue of my studies and what it means to be a Christian student, tied in with them, that will help me and that will ground me for what it means to be a Christian computer analyst or financial consultant or whatever it happens to be. So getting God's world right. Some of the skills and vocations that Scripture shows as enriching our culture under God's supervision: horticulture, botany, zoology, political administration, animal husbandry, arts and crafts, musicianship, urban planning, construction, accounting, writing, goldsmithry, perfumery. I just selected those at random. But that just shows you that whatever field you go into, and there's lots of good literature on this. People like Paul Stevens have written on it for years. Tim Keller's Every Good Endeavor has a wonderful book on that. People like Amy Sherman, Tom Nelson and others have written on what it means to have a good theology of work, and shows how Scripture gives that wide field of whatever work or field you go into, you are being a steward of God's creation. So get the university right when you're there. University originally meant bringing the vast range of human thought and exploration into a unified uni, university, a unified whole under the presupposed banner of God's truth. That's how the first universities were set up. God was presupposed to be the ultimate intelligence. And what has happened since the fall and is disintegration and fragmentation. They're part of the fall. And therefore now you get everybody specialising. And there doesn't seem to be a big story. There doesn't seem to be a unifying, coherent story. And as Christians, we have a unique opportunity to reintegrate and to show how all truth is God's truth. So getting the university right means seeing theology, that used to be called the Queen of the Sciences, standing over and above all the other disciplines. That's a picture of Reykjavik University, privilege of visiting there last year. And there's three pillars, and they said that the three pillars stood for the three disciplines of medicine, law, and theology. Fascinating that theology was there as one of the overriding disciplines. I'm going to go into a bit of application now before we finish about some of the idols that we might have to beware of. But anybody got any thoughts, first of all? What we're doing first of all was looking at the whole issue of what it meant to integrate your faith with your whole existence, not just the enrichment or the evangelism or the ethics. That was more what it meant to apply Christianity to your academic studies and to think like that. We're going on now to some practical, I suppose, lifestyle applications. But any questions? Okay, after this there will be time for general questions, so do jot them down if you can. First of all, some common idols. Ambition will be a massive one, I think, for you both at college, and that will set the and working life, that will set the tone for working life. First of all, the ambition to please others. Might be your parents. It might just be your peers. But it will be something that will be there, I think, lurking in the background all the time. The temptation to please others. Or to prove yourself. Maybe you think, listen, I want to show that I can do this. I want to show that I can get the grades. I want to show that I can actually get the job and get the interview. And to do it, or simply to get ahead materialistically. And of course, if God gives you opportunities and you get a good job, etc., etc., that's grand. But make sure that ambition has not become your idol. I have come across far too many enthusiastic young Christians who, high school and then at university. But it was money and ambition that basically were the thorns that choked the plants. In the parable of the sower, the deceptiveness of wealth is how Jesus puts it. And that can be there. Don't let it get in. Friends, it might be simply that you fear ostracism. You don't want to be isolated. You don't want to be pushed outside. You don't want to be dropped. And therefore you perhaps hide who you are. You try to fit in. And that's a massive temptation. Always is. It's as strong at college and working life as it is at school. It doesn't get any easier. But also when their values conflict with yours. It's fascinating, as I was reading some of the blogs that were going over the last few years on the same-sex marriage sexuality debate. There was a common theme with some of them, from young Christians or those who would have professed Christianity, who would have said, listen, I used to believe what you believe until my friend came out as gay. And when it's a choice between my friends and my beliefs, my friends will always win. You see what I said earlier about the first commandment? When it's a choice between your friends, you think you're being a good friend, but you're actually denying yourself, or you're actually making that your God. And the other thing what that exposes, when you say, I used to believe what you believed until my friend came out as gay, what they're essentially saying was that I was a raving homophobe until I actually met somebody who was gay, and then it changed my whole mind. You know, if you're only saying I believed that but I didn't actually know any gay people, then what was the point in believing that? You know, you believe it because it's right, it's true for everybody, whether they're heterosexual or homosexual. And And therefore, very often, the friendship, there will be a tension there. I'm not undermining that. It's a massive issue for many young Christian students because this has become such a massive issue in our society of how you negotiate that minefield where you can say to somebody, listen, I don't necessarily approve of what you're doing, but I still love you and I'll still be your friend. You know, it's not necessarily any different than it was when I was living in a college corridor many years ago as a student. And, you know, everybody else in the corridor was sleeping around and coming in drunk. I was still their friend. It didn't mean that I condoned what they were doing. Don't let your friends become an idol simply because their values conflict with yours. Or also, when you choose them to provide only what God can give. This, I guess, is in the whole area of romantic relationships, marriage, partner choice, all of that. If it's not money and ambition, the other thing that really blunts some people's spirituality or even exposes the fact that it was never there in the first place is when they decide to choose a marriage partner or a boyfriend, girlfriend who doesn't share their faith, and it inevitably pulls them away. Inevitably pulls them away. Pastorally, I can say that. I've seen it far too often, because they're choosing this person to provide what only God can give. They think, folks will say to me, listen, you know, I can live with a foot in both camps, I can do that. It doesn't work. And it's because essentially when you're entering into a romantic relationship, when you're thinking of choosing a life partner, the most crucial area in that will be, does that person share your identity as a forgiven child of God, called to live a radically different lifestyle? If your faith is just in a compartment, then yes, of course you can go out with them and you can marry them, because you'll just take that little compartment off and you'll go off to church on a Sunday and you'll do that, and it'll just be another interest. You know, your partner might go to the football or go to the Pilates while you're doing church, but sure, that's all it is. No, it's not. It's not. It's about your passions. It's about your identity. It's about who you are. So another common idol can be friends. And also religion. I mean, the statistics are a little bit sketchy. But anecdotally, there's enough evidence of those who once were on fire. I mean, I'm talking about Christian Union presidents. I'm talking about people who have worked for the Christian Union movement, who are now nowhere. And what you're finding is that often, they were committed to a cause rather than the person. They thought, yes, this is something I can, you know, get my teeth into. This is something I can wave a flag for. But they were never committed to Christ. Or perhaps the output exceeded the intake. They were so talented and so good. They were up front. They were, you know, able to give. And they were able to speak. And they were able to be involved in the big events. But they were never taking in some of the stuff you would have heard this morning about rhythms of devotion. And then I think this is crucial. Either the proud mind overruled the godly heart, or the seduced heart overruled the godly mind. Let me say that again, because you need a heart and a mind in tune with God. Love the Lord your God with all your heart and mind and soul and strength. So either you'll find that a proud mind overrules a godly heart, or a seduced heart overrules a godly mind. A proud mind whereby you take... As I sadly saw with one student very recently, you become addicted to theological controversy. You love being able, you love the cut and thrust of the debate. You love being able to get one over on the other person. And you're able to give great apologetic answers to people who aren't believers. You're able to stump the non-believers. But you've become proud. And the godly heart has gone. You've won some battles but lost the war. And what's come up here has never made its way down here. Or else a seduced heart had overruled the godly mind. And it might be that you've been seduced away by wealth or by romance or love or sex or ambition, whatever. And therefore your mind knows that it's not right, but the heart has been seduced away. Often when I hear of somebody who has fallen away, and they'll say that it is intellectual reasons. They'll say, I no longer believe the Bible, or I no longer, and you dig underneath it. I think I can say this without exception. In every place, every case that has been presented to me as an intellectual reason why they gave up the faith, if you dig deep enough, there has been a moral reason underneath it all. And the intellectual reason has been used as an excuse. You might want to come back on that. So let's apply this. Understand grace. Back to who you are. You're not what you've achieved or what you've earned, because all of that has been by God's grace. You're not the mistakes you've been made and the failure that you think you are, because that has been forgiven by God's grace. And if he has buried it in the bottom of the sea, and if he has trodden it underfoot and removed it as far as the east is from the west, then what right have you to still remember it? So grasp grace. On one level, you can't do anything more to earn God's love. You can't make a mistake big enough. You can't do an act of mercy large enough that will make him love you more or less. And moving forward means that you really, really grasp God's grace. Grasp community. Never absent yourself or isolate yourself from the Christian church. Particularly at university, we often say to folks, listen, the CU may be your primary force of primary locus of Christian activity, but it's not your church. We ask all our leaders to be involved in their local church, because the CU is simply an application of that on campus where churches can't go. And therefore, when you move on, and maybe you move cities, and maybe you have to, getting involved in a local church is probably the first thing that you should be doing. One of my staff, I think, was very wise in this. When they moved cities, they spent time. They didn't just jump into a local church, but they didn't hop around forever. They decided, we will go to four different churches a month at a time, of different flavours, all within the wider evangelical spectrum, but with an easy commute of where we're living. Four different denominational expressions. Go to one for a month at a time, and then we will decide. And that was good research, and yet they were committed to being involved in the local church. If you're moving away, I recommend it. I might get into trouble for this. I feel like putting my hand over the microphone or over the recorder at this time, in case your minister back home gets to hear this. But I think it's okay to change churches at a transition. I've seen some people that have been in a church they've grown up in all their life. They've gone to college and they've gone home at weekends and still gone to that church. They've got a job and they're under so much pressure to go back to that church because they owe so much to them. They formed them in discipleship. They nurtured them. They prayed for them. They maybe even financially supported them. They feel they owe them so much. But that's the kingdom view of this. That church hopefully will continue to do that. And the church I go to, we talk about giving our life away. Nobody has a right to hold on to people forever. And sometimes, so that you can develop your own spiritual life and stand on your own two feet and not be your mummy's boy or your daddy's girl, especially if your mummy or daddy's a pastor, you might need to move. And that will be, I think, a maturing opportunity. You might want to come back to me on that one. And then the expulsive power of a new affection. That comes from a guy called Thomas Chalmers, who says the only way to dispossess it of an old affection is by the expulsive power of a new one. This really means those sins that are besetting you, those voices that you keep listening to, telling you of failure and everything else, they won't be expelled by you trying harder. They won't be expelled by you reading more books, although that might be helpful. The only way some of that stuff that ensnares you still will be expelled is if you have a new affection that is even stronger than the old one. That if you find in Christ more than you find in the thing that's pulling you away. And so, just to go back, understand that it is by getting to know Christ more and look at Christ and what he offers, that you will be able to live this integrated life. Avoid reductionism. The gospel is not just about saving souls. Reductionism says, hey, the gospel is just about saving souls. That means that God will be excluded from most of your waking hours. Because I imagine even those of you who are natural evangelists, you still only do that for a very, very small percentage of your waking hours. Does the gospel have nothing to say about the rest of your life? Avoid compartmentalization. That's just a big word that I like to put up there, see if anybody can get more than 20 letters. Which says that God's only interested in some areas of my life, usually the religious bits. Avoid that. Avoid utilitarianism, only studies or activities that will get me a job or money are worthwhile. Again, I've seen too many students push down a particular road because their parents think that will give them a good secure job with lots of money at the end of the day. And I can think of a couple of students I know who started, and it might have been law or architecture or medicine or business. And they wasted 3 years because they knew when they went in they weren't going to enjoy this, but hey, it'll be a good job. And they hated it. And eventually they had to take a year out, and then they started something that they were actually passionate about and gifted in instead. So please follow your heart when it comes to choosing your studies and choosing your career. Because those desires are God-given desires. Don't follow the money. Don't follow what somebody else is pushing you into. And finally, this is God's world. He created it, He redeemed it, and He's going to renew it. So get involved in it. The new heavens and the new earth will be the perfection of what we're working in and living in here and now. You're His child, but you're also His steward of the gifts He's given you. And whatever course you're doing, whatever work you go into, you are uniquely placed in there. There is no one else like you in that position at this time. So be a student of the world and of the Word, and let the Word inform how you view the world. Be a witness in word and deed. Not just talking about your faith, but showing how it impacts what you're doing. Be honest with yourself and God. This comes down to, I guess, lifestyle issues. It's going to be utterly pointless and unproductive and wrong for me to stand up and give you hard and fast answers about, you know, places you should go, things that you should do or eat or drink or not go or not eat or not drink or socialise or not socialise or anything. But you just be honest with yourself about your motivations and about your weaknesses as you study the Word and as you look. And sometimes I think this gives you an opportunity for great creativity. Again, there was a colleague of mine who said, you know, I've been invited to the stag party. And he's a good friend, somebody I've been talking to, he knows my faith for years, very close friend, known him all my life. I'm really not looking forward to this. It clashes with a work commitment, but to be honest, I could get out of it. And we were able to sit and talk, and I was saying, well, what if? What if you explain that it was a work commitment? Because it wasn't just a stag party, it was one of those stag weekends in Bratislava or something, you know. So, I said, what if you explain it as a work commitment that inevitably you can't go, but you organise something else for a few of you when you come back, and you are even more generous with your wedding present than you would have been, and then you actually compensate for that, and start to think creatively about some of these things, being honest with yourself, and honest with God in terms of your own weaknesses and your motivations and why you're doing things. Sometimes you do have to go way out of your comfort zone into situations that you're not comfortable with, simply because out of friendship for someone who you value. And again, if you're honest with yourself about that, then that's great. Be a lifetime learner. Never give up. Again, when you graduate, that's not the end of your learning, especially as a Christian. Really develop, use every opportunity for professional training as you're in the job. There's nothing wrong with getting promotion. There's nothing wrong with, because you're able to serve more, etc. It's when ambition corrupts that. That's the problem. But I'd love some of our graduates to be the ones who are formulating public policy in the civil service, who are able to be at the cutting edge of technology, who are able to be some of the new artists that are really making an impact. There's nothing wrong with being the best that you can be, and be a lifelong learner in that. And then lastly, be a grace grasper and a grace dispenser. Just back to that all the time. You need the gospel every day. There's a guy called Scotty Smith. I get his prayers every day. He's written, he's from the States, and he does these sort of daily email prayers. I met him a few years ago, and one of the things he said to me is a guy who's just retired as a pastor. He said, Monday, I need the gospel every day. And I'm thinking, wow, somebody of his experience and length of service and the influence he's had in his area of the States says that, how much more do we need the gospel every day in terms of knowing who we are in Christ? Because every day there will be other voices from the media, there will be other voices from our peers, there will be other voices from the culture telling us we're something else, telling us we're failures, telling us, on the other hand, yeah, you can be whatever you want to be. No, you can't. You can't be anything you want to be any more than I can be Lionel Messi, much as I would like to. God has made you who you are. And who you will be is totally tied up with your relationship with Him. So grasp that and then dispense that grace to others. Because this is a graceless society. This is a culture that is merciless. Where people are left on the scrap heap. Where people aren't given second chances. Where if you foul up, that's you finish. But the church is different. And we can model that. So what does it mean to be a Christian in the secular cathedral? All of that. Integrated life, getting God right, getting yourself right, getting the university right. Forsaking those idols and understanding grace. I hope some of that meets some of your expectations and some of those questions you had at the beginning about the biggest challenges. I think we can all fall under that. So enjoy your life at university if you're going up, while you're there and after you leave. Thanks.